Hi guys, thanks for listening. Thank you as well to those of you who donate to the Patreon account. I've launched a campaign to raise funds to buy a new iMac. My current computer has been in use for over 8 years, and it is affecting my ability to create new content. As previously stated, my Patreon account can be found at www.patreon.com/leaderone. For those of you who would prefer to make a one-time single donation, there is also the option to send money to my PayPal account. The email address to send it to is Morgan Rector, my last name spelled R-E-C-T-O-R, 331, Morgan Rector 331 at hotmail.com. Remember, any amount is fine. If $1 one time is all you wish to donate, it would be gratefully accepted. Thank you for all your support, whatever forms it has taken. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Human Monsters. January 19th, 1985, Mesquite, Texas. It was a Saturday afternoon, and Detectives Bob Holloman and Bruce Bradshaw both received one of the most pivotal phone calls of their careers. A half hour after Bob Holloman received the call, he was summoned to the office. He said to his wife, Molly, "Looks like we've got a child abduction. They think it's the real thing. I don't know when I'll be home." Bruce Bradshaw received a call from Bob Holloman. They were partners. He was informed that a minor female was missing. Bradshaw detected an undercurrent of anxiety in Holloman's voice. Holloman said, "I need your help." They arranged a rendezvous at the Charter Oaks apartment complex. When the detectives arrived, Holloman filled Bradshaw in on all the available information. Police received a call from Linda Meeks, mother of 5-year-old Christy Meeks. She was distraught and in a panic. What she told police was she was divorced and that Christy and Linda's son, Michael, 7 years old, were visiting for the weekend. While she was in the process of preparing the evening meal, Michael and 9-year-old Tiffany Easter, a neighbor, ran into the kitchen to tell her Christy walked away with a stranger. More detectives arrived to investigate. They began to canvass the neighborhood. Child abduction cases are time sensitive. Not one nanosecond can be wasted. Bruce Bradshaw interviewed Michael Meeks and Tiffany Easter. Michael was too traumatized to speak, but Tiffany said the three of them were roller skating on the sidewalk when a young man approached them. She described him as white, about 5'10", 165 pounds, with medium-length brown hair and bangs. He was unshaven, possibly with a mustache. He was wearing a pullover shirt, shorts, and tennis shoes. She said the man asked them if they would like some cookies. Tiffany was wary of the man and tried to steer Christy and Michael away from him by inviting them to her house. She said there were cookies on the premises. Michael followed her, but Christy stayed behind. Holloman spotted two boys in the building just south of where Christy was last seen. They said they saw her get into the man's car. The best they could do in terms of describing the car was to say it was small. Christy was last seen wearing a Color Me the Rainbow t-shirt, blue jeans, and Cabbage Patch Doll shoes. This was before the internet, cell phones, and Amber Alerts. So the next step for the detectives was to issue a statewide teletype. More officers were dispatched to the search. They went to nearby parks, empty fields, drainage ditches, and other isolated areas. At nightfall, Christy still hadn't been located. During the next few days, community volunteers searched the area. Aerial searches were conducted by plane. Photographs of Christy were distributed. Part of the process of elimination of narrowing down the search for a perpetrator started with family. Linda and Michael passed a polygraph, but Michael and Christy's father, Mike Meeks, was difficult. He blamed Linda for the disappearance, since the children were unsupervised at the time. He continued to badger the detectives for updates as the investigation proceeded, but there was little they could tell him. Days turned into weeks, weeks turned into months. A reward was offered for information leading to the whereabouts of Christy Meeks, but this produced no promising leads. A university art student, using descriptions provided to him by Michael Meeks and Tiffany Easter, created a composite sketch of the offender. Copies were disseminated throughout the community. There were no sex offender registries at the time, which made the investigation even more problematic. April 3rd. Two fishermen spotted something on the water that they assumed was a dead bird. It was floating in a cove at Lake Texoma. When they took a closer look, they discovered, to their horror, that it was no bird. It was a dead child. The body was determined to have been left in the water a long time before it was found. It was thoroughly decomposed. The physical features were so distorted by that point that the justice of the peace called in to identify the remains assumed upon first sight that it was a boy. A few days later, a pathologist discovered that it was actually a little girl. Her clothing: Cabbage Patch Doll shoes, blue jeans, and a Color Me Rainbow t-shirt. Her father was contacted and asked for consent to consult Christy's dentist to confirm through his records if the teeth on the corpse were a match. Mike and Linda's worst nightmare was confirmed. Bob Holloman was not the same after Christy's body was identified. He broke down upon sight of his wife when he got home. He said to his wife after getting home, they couldn't even tell what she was. This was merely a tipping point. Holloman's depression deepened to such a degree that one day his wife found him on the floor in their bedroom closet. He was crying in the dark, holding a gun in his hand. February 12, 1986. 10-year-old Tiffany Ibera was walking to school alone. As she walked past an idling van, a man got out and advanced towards her. She had a bad feeling about him and decided it was best to run. She took off, but she wasn't fast enough for him. He caught hold of her backpack within 10 feet. He wrapped his arms around her and dragged her back to the van. He opened the side door and pushed her in. He climbed up behind her and closed the door. Once in the van, the man stared at her for a few minutes. He asked her for her home phone number. She told him, and he called on an early model cellular phone known as a bag phone. He handed it to Tiffany. He said to her, "Tell your mother you've been kidnapped." Tiffany complied. Before she could say another word, the man grabbed the phone and hung up. He said to Tiffany, "You better not walk to school alone again. I've been watching you, and the next time, I won't let you go." He opened the door of the van and told her to get out. Tiffany ran home. She was terrified. She cried. The man followed her until she reached the driveway of the apartment complex where she lived. Satisfied, he drove away. Tiffany told her mother what happened, and after a fruitless search around the neighborhood to find the van, they told the principal at Tiffany's school. He called the Dallas Police Department. The police took statements from Tiffany and her mother. This intel did nothing to track down the offender. February 15th. 9-year-old Christy Proctor was walking home from a friend's house. She disappeared soon after. Nobody witnessed the method of abduction. She was last seen wearing a pink and white sweater, blue jeans, and white tennis shoes. There was only one clue left behind at the scene, and it indicated beyond a reasonable doubt that the kidnapping occurred at that spot. It was a personal memento that belonged to Christy, a heart-shaped plastic box given to her by her aunt for Valentine's Day. Her mother, Laura Proctor, found the box and knew she had just stumbled upon the scene of the crime. She was seized by a profound terror, and given what Christy likely experienced during the abduction, their anxiety was likely commensurate. Though she did not witness the crime, a neighborhood resident, Alberta Abundis, observed a strange man driving a white van with brown stripes. He was moving at a very slow speed. She got a good look at him, a white man with a large mole on the right side of his face. The Dallas Police Department realized that a serial predator was stalking the streets around Dobie Elementary School. Detectives interviewed Tiffany Ibarra once more. This time a police sketch artist drew up an impression of the offender's appearance. He was an unremarkable young Caucasian man with dark hair parted in the middle and a thick but neatly trimmed mustache. Christie's body was found in a field near Plano, Texas. It was deposited underneath a dirty, burned mattress. October 5th. Dorothy Sherrill was a single mother to two children, 6-year-old Shannon and 2-year-old David, in Thorntown, Indiana. They spent the weekend with their father and were now due to report home. She saw David in their front lawn. She said to him, "Where's Shannon?" He said, "Sissy went behind the trailer." Dorothy went to the back of the trailer, but Shannon was not there. She walked around the neighborhood calling Shannon's name, but this did not summon the girl either. She asked Shannon's friends where she was, but they too drew a blank. Many of the trailer park's residents were out enjoying the weather that day, but none of them happened to notice Shannon's disappearance. She was last seen wearing a white sundress with blue trim. She was barefoot. Panicking now, Dorothy contacted the town's marshal, Gary L. Campbell. After meeting with Dorothy, he spoke to her neighbors and some of the park's children. He called for reinforcements. To augment their search, 150 community volunteers got involved. Ground and aerial searches proved to be fruitless. At one point, the FBI and the Indianapolis Police Department contributed to the endeavor. The town's residents were gripped with fear, especially those with minor children. The panic escalated to the point where there were incidents of volunteers breaking into homes when the inhabitants were slow in answering the door. After 48 hours of searching, there was no path to the feet of Shannon Sherrill. Now priority one was to find the suspect. Her parents were ruled out as suspects after they both passed polygraph examinations. The children who last interacted with Shannon were hypnotized, but could not recall any details about the abduction. The only possible lead was that somebody spotted a white van they didn't recognize driving through the park. November 3rd, 1987. Two little girls were picking wildflowers in a field across from a large apartment complex. The youngest was a 3-year-old toddler. The other was approximately 5 years old. She was Hispanic. A man spotted them and pulled over in a gray sedan. He got out of his car and said to them, smiling, I have some candy for you. The older girl's name was Julia Diaz. She was streetwise enough to know better than to take him up on his offer. She shook her head. She said to the younger girl, Roxanne Reyes, "He's lying." The man lunged at her. She screamed and dodged him. He chased her across the street. There was a very narrow opening between two buildings. She was slim enough to fit through, but he was not. He was furious, but undaunted. He ran around to the other side of the building with the intention of intercepting her. He was tripped up when he collided with an older woman named Wanda Huggins. They exchanged a glance before he ran back to his car. Roxanne was still standing there in her light pink shorts and purple shirt. Unassuming as she was, she made no attempt to escape. The man punched her in the stomach as hard as he could. She was seized by panic as she gasped air back into her lungs. He threw her in the car. He sped out of the neighborhood. Julia ran to the apartment manager's office. Roxanne's mother, Tammy, was the manager. Neighbors and family members searched the neighborhood looking for Roxanne. A police artist took a description of the perpetrator from Julia. A young white man with a brown mustache, dark hair with long bangs swept to the side, a large mole on the right side of his face above his eyebrow. Roxanne was taken to a remote location close to the small township of Murphy, Texas. It was 15 miles away from her home. She was brutally raped. The offenders strangled the last vestiges of spirit out of her. He left her for dead near some woods. Her remains were discovered a year later. June 1996. Detective Gary Sweet of the Garland Police Department in Texas was rifling through old caches of evidence. The items were collected during the investigations of the aforementioned child abductions and murders. One folder contained a list of suspects with relevant data for each. One that caught Sweet's eye was David Elliott Penton. In April 1991, Penton was convicted in Columbus, Ohio, for the murder of Nydra Ross, a 9-year-old black girl who disappeared in March 1988. Her body was found in September that year in a heavily wooded area near a creek bed. Penton, who was 32 years old at the time, was a fugitive from Texas. There he was convicted in 1985 of involuntary manslaughter for shaking his infant son to death in Fort Hood. He received a 5-year sentence, but he was released on a bond pending appeal. He fled the state. He killed Nydra Ross while he was on the run. Penton resembled suspects drawn up in police artists' sketches for other cases. Sweet could not forget this detail. June 27, 2000. Detective Sweet received a phone call from Detective Diane Teft, who operated out of Fort Worth, Texas. She informed him that she was communicating with an Ohioan prison inmate by the name of Jeffrey Sonnenkalb. She discussed with him the details of a 14-year-old girl by the name of Julie Fuller. She was abducted and murdered in the Fort Worth area on June 23, 1983. Sonnenkalb wrote to Teft to inform her that a former cellmate, David Elliott Penton, intimated to him that Julie was one of his victims. Sonnenkalb shared a cell with Penton for 3 years at Warren Correctional Facility near Lebanon, Ohio. They were both held in segregation because they were sex offenders, and their lives would have been put at risk if they had been immersed in the general population. One of Penton's favorite pastimes was to brag about kidnapping, raping, and murdering little girls all over the U.S. of A. Aside from Julie Fuller, Penton also named Christy Meeks, Christy Proctor, and Roxanne Reyes. Sweet remembered all these names as he was haunted by what he read about the crimes. On a conference call with other police officers, Sonny Kalb gave more details. He said Penton bragged about incarcerating the girls in his van for as long as 3 days. He would rape them constantly throughout a 48-hour period. Once he got everything he wanted from the girls, he would strangle them to death. Typically, he would discard the body in an isolated field or wooded area. Sonny Kalb's knowledge of other aspects of the case checked out. He had credibility. He even mentioned details that were not disclosed to the media, like the clothing the victims were wearing when they were abducted. He noted that Penton also boasted about murdering a child in Van Zandt County, Texas. Teft informed Sweet that DNA evidence taken from Julie Fuller's body was to be compared to David Penton's DNA. 5 days later, she learned they were not a match. Though Sonny Kalb's credibility was shot with most police, Sweet kept pursuing him for more facts regarding Penton. He asked him how they first broached the topic of murdering children. Sonny Kalb said, "We were watching the Oprah Winfrey show about the Christie Proctor case. It was almost like he went into a trance when they started talking about it. Then he started correcting the facts that they were getting wrong. That's when he told me he did it." He mentioned that Penton preferred victims of color, such as African Americans, Hispanics, and Asians. Sometimes he would abduct a child of another race if the opportunity happened to present itself. He targeted children from indigent neighborhoods because he assumed nobody would care if they disappeared, given their socioeconomic status. He dubbed them throwaway kids. Sonny Kalb conceded that it was possible Penton was lying and/or embellishing the details of his crimes to impress other inmates. He claimed to have killed as many as 50 girls, starting in South Korea when he was in the army, and later throughout Midwestern America and the Southern states. Sonny Kalb always felt that the number was likely closer to 25. Said Penton listed dates and other intricate details of the crimes that were consistent with the official record. Penton felt he was smarter than the police and loved to brag about it. He was meticulous in his planning and careful in execution. He scouted areas for body disposal well in advance to ensure there would be no witnesses. He wasn't like so many other murderers who were undone by their lack of impulse control. He would take the victims to other jurisdictions to confuse law enforcement, who typically did not operate as a network. The ego trip led to Penton's downfall. He delighted in recounting his crimes. He would relive them in thought and word time and time again in graphic detail. They could be discussing something completely unrelated, but Penton would steer the conversation around to the topic of what he did to the girls. Sonny Kalb's impression was that Penton's tendency to regale the other inmates with these tales became a sexual outlet. He also mentioned that he hoped to get out of prison so he could rape and murder more girls. If they were watching television and a little girl appeared on the screen, Penton would say something to the effect of, "She better be glad I'm in here, or I would have her." He said that next time he wouldn't punch them in the stomach to disable them. He would use a taser instead. Sweet consulted with authorities in Ohio, who told him Penton would be eligible for parole in 2027 for the Nidra Ross case. He would be 69 years old. Sweet wanted to do everything in his power to ensure this would not happen. His next step was to devour all available information about Penton. First things first, David Elliott Penton was born on February 9, 1958, in Columbus, Ohio. He and his sister were raised by a single mother after his father abandoned the family. He dropped out of high school in 1977 and joined the Army. He was stationed in Fort Hood. He met a woman named Catherine, who happened to be his stepsister, though their relationship did not begin on those terms. They had a daughter together. They divorced in 1979. When they separated, Penton kept their white van with brown stripes on the side. Penton married a Korean national named Kyung in February 1980. 3 months later, he was transferred to Korea, where he was trained as a track vehicle mechanic. He was a highly skilled marksman and was considered highly motivated by his commanding officers. He was promoted to sergeant. He was caught hiding alcohol in his footlocker and lying about his marital status to attain unearned benefits. He was demoted to specialist. In June 1981, he was transferred to Fort Hood for a year. He was sent to Korea again. He finished his tour of duty in 1983. He moved to Texas with his wife and daughter. They had a son a year later. November 1984. Penton was arrested for killing his 2-month-old son. After his son cried unrelentingly, Penton flew into a rage and shook him. In May of 1985, he pleaded guilty to manslaughter and was dishonorably discharged from the Army. He appealed for a delay in his sentencing. He was allowed out on bond. He left Texas and disappeared. He wasn't heard from again until he murdered Nidra Ross 3 years later. He worked with Nidra's uncle. He assisted in the search to avoid suspicion. It was before that event that Christy Meeks, Christy Proctor, and Roxanne Reyes were abducted and murdered. Penton got sloppy when he murdered Nidra Ross. He stuck too close to home and was seen interacting with Nidra before her disappearance. What's more, a large blood stain was found on the carpet underneath one of the seats in his van. DNA blood sequencing was still in its infancy, so this did not factor into the investigation. 6 months after she went missing, Nidra's skeletal remains were discovered by a hunter. She was identified after blood and bone marrow samples taken from her mother were analyzed and compared. Penton's trial for this crime began on April 4, 1991. He was charged with aggravated murder and kidnapping. The death penalty was considered in the event that he be convicted. His cellmates related to the court what Penton told them about the murder. His ex-wives testified against him, alleging that he molested their daughters. During a second trial, which is part of the process in Ohio when considering the death penalty, the jury decided that the aggravating factors did not outweigh the mitigating circumstances. Instead of getting the electric chair, Penton received a life sentence with the possibility of parole. In January of 1987, Penton's sister Amanda moved with her husband to Oklahoma. Once there, she was relieved to be free of the presence of her brother. She was concerned about what he might do to her children. To quote Amanda, "I believe David is capable of hurting children. I believe that David did murder those children in Texas. I just hope you can prove it and get him locked up. I will not take my children to Columbus while David is there. So, if you can charge him with these murders and he goes to prison for it, I hope you will let me know so that I can visit Columbus again. I don't want my children around him. I don't want them molested." Gary Sweet tracked down the adult Tiffany Abera on the phone. He said to her, "Do you think you can remember what the man who kidnapped you looked like?" She said, "I can remember him like it happened yesterday. I can still see him in my dreams." Bob Holloman published an article in the January 1990 edition of D Magazine. It was entitled, "A Letter to Christie's Killer." This is that article. "I think about you often. Usually at the oddest moments. Driving to the grocery. Mowing the lawn. Standing in line at the bank. Your image unaccountably leaps to mind. Produced by some randomly firing neuron in that section of my brain normally reserved for recurrent night terrors and childhood boogeymen. Since January 19, 1985, you have never been far from my mind. That day is indelibly etched in my psyche, as it must be in yours. But, of course, for different reasons. Let me introduce myself. I am a policeman. Maybe you saw me on TV babbling to some earnest reporter about the incident. Since 1985, I have moved on to different police assignments. 3 years investigating child sex crimes took an emotional toll that is frankly inexpressible. But there are some cases one never truly relinquishes. After describing the events that transpired during the day Christie vanished, he continued, "The weeks and months that followed are forever embedded in my memory. You will pardon the cliché emotional roller coaster, but I have no other adequate means of describing the false starts, dead-end leads, and blind alleys my colleagues and I encountered during that terrible time. And worn clichés do little to convey the anguish of parents simultaneously consumed with hope, horror, and dread. The taking of any human life is tragic, but it is different when a child is killed. I do not know if you understand tragedy in its truest sense. Real, visceral tragedy. As yet, having been spared the loss of loved ones, I must confess that I possessed only an academic comprehension of the term until January 1985, and the sense of tragedy I feel now is but a pallid approximation of that inflicted upon the parents of Christie Meeks. You have educated me about other extreme emotions as well. As you might reasonably expect, I have a considerable amount of hatred for you. While you do not know me, I do know a little about you, your approximate age, height, weight, and hair color. These mundane details recorded on a crime report form the basis of our acquaintance. They represent the raw material, the monochromatic details from which we are expected to compose a completed portrait of you. In any police investigation, the canvas is added to by degrees. The bold brush strokes represent hard information gleaned from witnesses and physical evidence. The more subtle shadings are the result of experience in dealing with your kind. As you are doubtless aware, your portrait is presently far from finished, but after several years of dealing with individuals who abuse, maim, and kill children, I have some inkling of your background. Laymen, repelled by the horror of these crimes, often have the mistaken impression that people like you bound fully grown from some wellspring of unfathomable evil. Some may even believe that an aberrant twisting of DNA doomed you to commit your offense. I can only speculate as to the horrors of your youth. Perhaps the atrocities you endured fomented a rage so profound that you were compelled to repeat them, to act them out, as pop psychologists term it. It is easy to be seduced by pity for you, to want to see you only as a product of a disordered and abusive environment. This provides an explanation for your crime, and people desperately seek explanations for such horrific crimes. But an explanation, no matter how rational, does little to alter the brutal reality of your offense. I am deeply sorry for you, but do not expect forgiveness. Forgiveness implies a measure of understanding and mercy I am unable to muster. I often wonder how you feel, how you exist. I know you must fear the late night knock at your door. The consuming dread must tear at you. Do you sleep soundly, or have you awakened at some early morning hour, sweat-drenched, heart-pounding, because of a child's face thrust into your dreams? Do you remember? The face? That of a 5-year-old girl? That face will reappear again and again, perhaps sometimes accompanied by another face as well, one you might not recognize, a visage vaguely defined and hazily indistinct. To suggest that your night terrors are caused by simple fear of capture does you an injustice. More sinister devils torture you. You have a conscience, albeit one stunted by abuse, and you know that you will be visited forever by an innocent, open, wondering face, and its avenging companion. Just as you are my nightmare, I am yours. Holloman retired in 1998. By then he was battling depression and an addiction to oxycodone. He developed an anger management problem. His marriage fell apart, and he and his wife were divorced. Other officers investigating these crimes took their work home with them, so to speak, and the consequences were dire for their personal relations. Albert Mulligan was an inmate who did time with David Penton. He told detectives that he drew a picture of his daughter, who died young. He depicted her ascending to heaven. Penton took the drawing and added breasts to the girl's chest. He also drew a merry-go-round and swing set. He finished by drawing a lake. To quote Mulligan, I asked him about the lake. He said it was in Texas. Mulligan noted that Penton's eyes would gloss over as he regaled him with his murders, sparing him no graphic details. He recalled that Penton absolutely loved reliving the agony and horror he inflicted on children. Their reactions to it were equally satisfying to him as all other aspects of the crime. He told Mulligan that there were 4 or 5 bodies of dead children in Texas he left behind. Investigators went to a house in Columbus where Penton and his family lived. They dug up floorboards this time. They found the kind of costume jewelry that would be typically worn by little girls. The 3 bodies that were found had so badly decomposed by the time they were discovered that there was no way for forensic investigators to determine if they were subjected to bondage and rape. According to jailhouse informants, Penton would keep his victims alive for several days, constantly raping and torturing them. There were photos in his cell on which he had written the letter A. A stood for anal assault. An inmate known as Donald Harvey, a serial killer known publicly as the Angel of Death, served time alongside David Penton. He said Penton talked about attacking girls in Texas, Louisiana, and Arkansas. He also claimed to have victims in Indiana. Other than that, Harvey had little to say about David Penton, other than he felt Penton was a pedophile because he had a small penis, and it is Harvey's theory that all pedophiles are underendowed. Many of the accounts given by former cellmates of the stories Penton told them about his crimes were consistent with the details known to law enforcement officials. Inmate Howard Goyher reported some info that most of the others had not. He related one incident when Penton was pulled over by a police car while Christy Meeks was still alive and hidden in the trunk. To quote Goyher, he said he was going to kill the officer if he asked to look in the trunk, but the officer let him go. From there, Goyher revealed that Penton fantasized about getting released from prison so he could rape and murder more little girls. He even devoted a great deal of time formulating new ways to subdue them. Penton became aware that an investigation was underway to prove his culpability in crimes for which he was not yet charged. After this, he changed his tune. To quote one informant, "It's funny. For years, he's been bragging to anybody who'll listen about raping and murdering those little girls. But now, he says it was all a lie, and that he'd never hurt a child." Detectives interviewed unreliable witnesses. They pursued leads that led to nothing. The investigation was ongoing for over 2 decades, but Sweet and his colleagues would not rest until David Penton faced justice for all his crimes. Gary Sweet and Bruce Bradshaw secured an interview with David Penton. When Penton entered the room and became wise to the purpose of the meeting, the blood drained from his face. He pissed his pants. Literally. He crossed his legs in a futile attempt to hide his incontinence. He tried to save face by saying, "I'm glad you guys are here. I wanted to tell you that I didn't do these crimes I've been accused of. Sweet said, you misunderstand. We didn't come here to talk about whether or not you did it. We know you did it. We just wanted to meet you before we bring you back to Texas and kill you. Penton, I didn't do anything. Sweet, we aren't here to talk about it. Like I said, we just wanted to meet you before we bring you back to Texas to kill you. Bradshaw, David, we know you did it. Sweet, David, I give you credit. You were very good at it. Look how long it took us to catch you. Penton was flattered. He even smiled. Be that as it may, he still professed to be innocent. Bradshaw and Sweet talked about the murders and what they believed he had done. Bradshaw, what if I told you we searched your house in Columbus and found something in the attic? Penton, I would say that was a lie. I never took any souvenirs. I'm smarter than that. And if I had taken anything, all I'd have to do is call my mom. She loves me and would get rid of anything for me. You can't have anything but circumstantial evidence. I'm not stupid. I didn't leave any evidence. Sweet, did you use a condom? Penton, I meant that I didn't leave any evidence because I didn't do it. Bradshaw and Sweet spent the next couple of hours playing mind games with Penton in hopes that they would trick him into confessing. At one point, Sweet told Penton about a prosecuting attorney in Texas named Greg Davis. He has been dubbed the Grim Reaper because he was so effective in sending murderers to death row. Sweet, if he wants you dead, you're going to die. The detectives mentioned Davis's nickname frequently to unsettle Penton. Penton, tell the Grim Reaper that I will confess if he pays off my debt to the state of Ohio and gets me a color TV for my cell. Sweet, we're not here to play Let's Make a Deal. Penton laughed. Penton, I ain't going to say shit while my mom's alive. The next morning, Penton was brought in for more questioning. This time, two more detectives were present with Sweet and Bradshaw. Penton was a broken record. Penton, I would never do anything like that. Bradshaw was an expert on pedophiles in terms of their behavior, personalities, and criminal methodology. He interviewed several of them and began to recognize patterns. He knew what to say to Penton. He took the tack of conveying that he understood Penton. This was done in hopes that it would make him more comfortable. Under these circumstances, he discussed his sexual proclivities more freely. Bradshaw, I've been thinking about this for years and years, and what I think happened is you got her in the car, and then when you were having sex with her, she started screaming. So you put your hand over her mouth and suffocated, or strangled her. After a moment of silence, the detectives reminded Penton they were taking him to Texas to be executed. Penton shrugged. Penton, okay, then I guess I'll die. Sweet, what do you think is going to happen to you after you die? Penton, I'm right with God, so I'm not worried. I'm a man of God. Prison officials warned Sweet not to engage in theological discussions with Penton. To quote one officer, he'll try to lure you into a discussion to sidetrack you. Sweet, we know you killed these girls, but God will forgive you, and you can be a man after God's own heart. Penton, but I didn't kill them. Sweet, David, you're lying, and the Bible says that God hates a liar. I believe if you have repented these murders, that God will forgive you, just like he forgave King David, but not if you lie to cover up a sin. Yet again, Penton insisted he was innocent. Sweet, you can tell us that you're innocent, and you can tell the judge that you're innocent, but someday you will stand before another judge that you won't be able to say that to. He knows everything you've done. Suddenly, Penton sprang to life and began shouting, "We will all stand before God, all of us, and you may be standing with me." Penton was satisfied with this assessment of the situation. He smiled with pride. "Sweet. That's right, David, and those little girls will be standing with us, too." The color drained from Penton's face. He froze. He was nearly catatonic for a moment. He swallowed and said the only thing he could think of. "Good. Then they can tell you I didn't do it." Sweet quoted a proverb to Penton. "Whoever conceals their sins does not prosper, but the one who confesses and renounces them finds mercy." Penton was trapped with no comeback. "Sweet, we'll be waiting for you in Texas." All the evidence gathered by detectives was submitted to Texan prosecutors. John Roach, Collin County District Attorney, announced that his office would pursue charges against David Penton. He also indicated to the Dallas Morning News that they would seek the death penalty. Dallas Morning News also gathered some victim impact statements. Linda Meeks: "Thank you, Lord. It's been a long time coming, a long 18 years. I'm shocked, nervous, scared, all rolled into one." Linda mentioned that she had had an emotional breakdown in the months following the discovery of her daughter's body. She was so beset by grief that, to quote Linda, "I had to have my sister show me where Christie's grave was later on." She mentioned that before they found Christie's body, she never gave up hope. As Linda put it, "I just thought, if he doesn't get his day here on earth, he'll get it on Judgment Day when he leaves this earth." She went on to say that she hoped her daughter's death has helped future potential victims. In a roundabout way, it helped bring in media attention and public awareness. It showed that it could happen to anybody. It's not because you didn't want your child. Christie's father, Mike, described the impact on his family. "The whole family is hurt and relieved by it all. It's affected my son, and he's felt guilty about this for so long. It'll be a great comfort for him." He described the years following Christie's disappearance as, quote, "torture. I haven't been able to do anything right in a long time. I need this for myself, and I need this for my children. I think it's going to help a lot." Roxanne's mother, Tammy Lopez, described her feelings about the prosecution of David Penton for offending against her daughter. "Relief. As she put it, I know he's not going to go through the pain like my little girl did, or those other two little girls, but it's comforting to know he'll get what's coming to him. My mother and stepfather saw this guy's picture in a paper when he was charged with killing Nidra Ross in Ohio. It matched a composite drawing released by Garland police. But I've been told to say no more right now, so it won't spoil the case. I want this guy put down for what he did." D.A. Roach praised the detectives from Garland, Mesquite, and Plano for their hard work in their relentless pursuit of justice. As he said, "They are to be commended for their dedication, hard work, and coordinated investigation in preparing and presenting these cases for prosecution. The acceptance and prosecution of these cases will serve as notice to anyone who would abduct and murder our children that we will not forget. We will not forget the killer, we will not forget the crime, and we will not forget the victims." Detective Sweet received the phone call he had dreamed of for so many years. Greg Davis informed him that David Elliott Penton was going to be tried for murdering three little girls. August 2003, David Penton was extradited to Texas to stand trial for the murders of Roxanne Reyes, Christy Meeks, and Christy Proctor. When he was taken to Collin County Jail, Gary Sweet, Bruce Bradshaw, Don Phillips, and Billy Meeks were waiting for him. For once, they were glad to see him, for now he was exactly where they aimed to put him. Indeed, Bruce Bradshaw said to him, "We told you we were going to bring you back." Penton said nothing. January 10, 2004. The district attorney's office agreed to accept an offer from the defense. Penton agreed to plead guilty to the three murder charges. The conditions were that he be sentenced to life without parole. The death penalty under these circumstances would not factor into his sentence. Petain confirmed to the judge that he was guilty of the crimes for which he was charged. The families of the victims were not happy with these conditions. Mike Meeks was particularly angry, feeling that the death penalty was the appropriate punishment. He felt betrayed by Greg Davis. To quote Meeks, "For 18 months, I've been told this man was going to die. I was told from day one that this was a death penalty case. They're taking the easy way out, in my opinion." Tammy Lopez pointed out to members of the press that Petain was devoid of remorse from what she could tell at the hearing. To quote Lopez, "He killed our children, but he also killed us. He destroyed their lives, and he also destroyed our lives. And we're the ones paying." She described Petain as a devil. She wanted the case to go to trial and hoped Petain would get the death penalty. She foresaw an eternity of persecution awaiting him beyond the gates of hell. As she put it, "Because God knows what he did, and he will be punished. I know he's not going to go through the pain my daughter went through, but he's going to go through pain." Laura Proctor made a statement. "Essentially, he'll die in jail." Her father, Howard, added that though there was, quote, "some sense of closure, I personally would have preferred the death penalty." March 4th, 2007. After refusing most interview requests, David Petain agreed to speak with Kenneth Dean, who wrote for the Tyler Courier-Times-Telegraph. Petain saw himself as a victim of false accusations and a corrupt justice system. A few quotes. "This is my philosophy. There is no justice in America. No more for me, at least. I am a poor defendant who cannot afford a top-notch defense team. Society isn't worried about me. They have labeled me a predator, and I have accepted that. If I don't die by lethal injection, I'm going to die of old age. I know that, and my health is failing anyway. I'm just tired of fighting, and I'm tired of being put through the ringer. And you know, you get to the point where you will find yourself to die because you get sick of it. If I fell over dead tomorrow, it would be doing everybody a favor. Then everyone could conjecture, well, we didn't get him to trial, but we still think he did it." The following is a dialogue between Kenneth Dean and David Petain. Dean, "Did you ever rape, try to kidnap, or fantasize about kidnapping little girls?" Petain, "I've already told you, no. Here's the thing. If I did it, then I'd tell you I did it. Did you rape and murder Nigel Ross?" "I'm not going to comment on that." "Why not? You just said you would tell me." "Look, I have 400 agencies investigating me right now. So they're going to come up and say, well, he confessed to this and confessed to that, and let's just go ahead and bank him." "So you are saying all these agencies involved and all these people, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation, have got a conspiracy to keep David Petain behind bars and pin all these cases on him?" "Yes, let me tell you what the FBI told me. They said they were going to remain neutral in the Texas cases." "How can they remain neutral? If I did it, then I did it. If I didn't, then I didn't." "Have you bragged about killing kids?" "Why would I go around bragging about killing kids? I don't have to brag about killing so other inmates will leave me alone. I'd just pick up a mop handle and bop them in the head." "Did you kill Christy Proctor, Christy Meeks, or Roxanne Reyes?" "No, I did not." "Did you kill any other kids?" "No, I have told you I didn't go around killing kids." "So you are telling me that you have never killed any children, including Nigel Ross?" "I didn't say that. What I'm saying is, if I did it, then I did it. And I said I'm not talking about the Ross case." "But by your admission, Through pleading guilty to the Reyes, Meeks, and Proctor cases and your two previous convictions, you have killed 5 kids, right? Correct. Have you ever been to East Texas? Yes, I have been through there several times. I lived in Texas for 5 years, but I didn't know anyone there. Where were you on April 2nd, 1986? Was that a weekday or a weekend? Because if it was a weekday, I was working in Ohio, and a lot of times I worked on weekends. But yes, I was in Texas in the 1980s. I was stationed there. If you were getting that needle in your arm, are you finally going to say, I'm going to tell them what I've done in life before they put that needle in my arm? I'm going to call everybody and tell them everything so I will have a clear conscience. Will it be a lot more than what you were saying you have done? No, no more than what you know already. Accept it or reject it. That is up to you. When someone sits down and writes the next book about serial killers, will your name be at the top of the page? Oh, absolutely. Does that give you cause for concern? No. Why not? Because there is nothing I can do about it. I'm just a monster, a hideous idiot, a demon from hell that goes around the country killing little kids. And I've been labeled that, and no one listens to me. David, we may not be listening to you, but we haven't forgotten what you've done. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Bye for now.